Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today we're talking about color.
And we just learned that there are creatures out there who can see colors that we can't even imagine.
Like the amazing mantis shrimp.
I would so love to be a mantis shrimp and see what the mantis shrimp sees.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that actually brings us back to Jay Knights.
I'm a professor of ophthalmology, University of Washington, Seattle.
Jay has actually spent his entire career trying to get creatures to see colors that they normally can't see. And he started, this is kind of an interesting story, by taking some colorblind monkeys who couldn't see red.
They have blue cones, green cones, but no red cones.
Which is not unlike a lot of human males. In any case, he had these monkeys and was able to take the human gene for the red cone, wrap it in a virus, inject it into the monkey's eyes, and bam, the monkeys suddenly had red cones.
Yeah.
Oh, my
God. So it had blue, green, and red.
Was this like LASIK? So it was just like a 10-minute outpatient situation for the monkeys?
I would say close. Close to LASIK.
Could they then now see red?
Well, every single morning before they get their breakfast, they have to do their color vision test. So
we'd sit each monkey at a computer.
We had a touch screen.
And the screen looks totally gray. But in that field of gray, he adds a little red blob.
Right.
Now here's the key.
We use grape juice as the reinforcement.
For the monkeys.
But
the game is,
you have to touch the blob before you get your juice.
So before the surgery, they weren't seeing any blobs, and they weren't getting any juice. Because all they could see was gray. So a little red blob could be right there in front of them, and they'd never see it. And the morning after their LASIK color booster shot.
Okay. Touch it if you see it.
They still couldn't see it. Day after day, they would do their test.
Mm-hmm.
And every day they would fail.
Every day they would fail.
No blob. No juice.
But it's fun for them. They get out of their cage and they talk to their friends and...
Did you fail? Yeah, I failed. You failed? I failed.
Another day, another fail.
Until one morning, after about
20 weeks,
Jay woke up the monkeys, gave them the test.
And they began to not fail.
Really?
Now that is such a great start to the program, partly because you get into the story so quickly and you build momentum right away. How do you do that? I mean, how do you think about starting a show?
Well, actually, you notice it didn't really start. It bumbled artfully. It's a funny way of starting, but it's a false start, which builds a tension, and it's at several levels. The music in particular, I thought, in that is ingenious.
So you don't actually want to announce we're starting a radio show here.
No,
well,
you know,
was in the middle, actually, wasn't it?
It was somewhere in the middle. You kind of want to seduce people into the dream before they realize what's happening. And if you do the sort of the normal announcery thing, okay, now we begin our segment B, and this is Radio Lab, and our topic today is this. It's somehow, all of those things feel like tune-out cues to me.
Mm-hmm.
You want to kind of lure them in, and suddenly you're like, oh, wait, what's happening? Where are we? Oh, okay.
Because that's a lot like how people are. I mean, you do need to rack focus oftentimes. So you're having a lemonade, and your daughter comes up and wants to show you her picture, but then the cat seems to be peeing in the corner. And then you have to make all kinds of choices. What do I look at? Mm. And so you have to wind in some direction. And that's true, particularly if you're going to do something complicated. So this is we know about you, and you know about us, and we don't do it fast. We do it like real people do it. Like,
but, I mean,
where
I have
are
to,
we?
I have to say, as a fellow radio producer, I mean, what I marvel so much about the way you started this segment is how fast you get into it, and how much you pack into 30 seconds or a minute, and then how you sort of ratchet up the story in
a
way.
You know, but it's a fast slow, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. the way that these things unfold and the way that we try to make them unfold is they have a kind of quickening pace, but actually if you sort of look at what's happening, it's moving very, very slowly, step by step by step by step.
We've obviously fooled you completely. You think that you've just had an encyclopedia's dollop of knowledge. You've had... we're going to like to talk to some monkeys and see if we can add red to them.
Well, you know, the way I see it is that, you know, if you talk to, I remember we interviewed once upon a time a computational linguist. It's one of those fields you didn't even know existed until you somehow have the opportunity to talk to them. And he referred to sentence ideas as idea density. Like there's an idea density to what you're doing. And I feel like the pace, the way that we pace things and the way we try and have things unfold, that there has to feel like there's an idea density to it. Like you're getting a couple different layers at once.
So tell me about that segment that we just heard then. I mean, so what went into that idea density of those 2.5 minutes?
Well, this is a story of a pretty remarkable achievement where you take people who see the world without red and suddenly give them red. Well, it's also a story that somehow resonates with a lot of guys, a lot of males. 10% of males, I believe, have that very problem, color blindness, either in their red or one other cone. So you want to fold that in. It's a story of a discovery, so it's sort of this classic hero's journey of, like, let me go out and discover something. So there's that story to tell. There's the idea simply that we're enjoying one another's company, so we're laughing, we're having a good time.
Yeah, but I think most subtle is actually the scoring. There's a musical bounce going underneath that I think probably Jed invented, mm-hmm. but it somehow allows you to bobble the ball. And this is at a level that's extremely subtle, but you are not feeling that you have an appointment with anything. You are just sort of meandering. And the music scoring gives you permission to do that. And no one ever says it. It's just there.
You're talking about the kind of music you play or when you insert the music?
If you go back and listen to the underscoring, which is actually extremely important, you'll hear this boom 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 boom. It's very, it's like a waddling penguin.
And is that partly just to get you in a certain mind space to be able to
permit you? I think.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, it's punctuational. You know, it's like you want to create space between thoughts, and so you want to, like, it's like when you bring the music in, it's like you're signaling that what you just heard was important. When you take it out, you're signaling what you just heard was important. There's all of those kinds of cues you're giving to people, mm-hmm. but it's also, you know, it's a the lumpity bumpy dum dum is sort of like permission, I think, is the right word that Robert just used. It gives you a permission to have a certain attitude toward this information, which is, it's not an attitude of expertise. It's not an attitude of we should know this or we, you know, this is just like people following their curiosities. And it has a sort of like a bumbling curiosity in the feel of the music. And
actually, it's almost like a literal musical version of Charlie Chaplin twirling his cane. He has big shoes, and he's going to, all kinds of awful things will happen to Charlie Chaplin, and beautiful things. But he goes into them as an innocent every day.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Now, Jed, your background is actually in music, right? You have done composition for music?
Yeah, this is all a mistake. whole radio thing.
So tell me, how does that inform what you do as a radio producer?
It's the funny thing is I discovered after being a failed composer for I won't say many years, because I learned quite quickly that I couldn't do it, is that I discovered, you know, after doing radio for a while, that actually the composition that I was trained in and the radio I'm doing now are weirdly the same thing. You know, they have become the same thing. Except you have this layer of story and narrative and ideas and reporting and journalism that sort of act as the shell around the music. And so, which is all the difference in the world for me. It helps me write music when I know that I have somewhere to go with it. So, you know, I started writing music for films, and I got maybe like a centimeter into that before having that kind of reckoning. But now I feel like I'm writing music for films again, but it's our films, our little sort of the films that exist between us and between our listeners.
So when you're actually putting together a piece, at what point does the music come into the story? I mean, have you sort of figured out what everyone is saying first, and then is music the last step?
It's not the last step. I mean, you start to think ahead, maybe 10 or 12 paces in, you're like, okay, I'm starting to hear. There's a point at which you're making a story and you begin to hear it. You begin to actually say, oh, I can imagine how this is going to live.
Or you begin to not hear it. You'll put something in, and it says to you, nope, which is an interesting thing to learn.
And it's the funny thing is it's always, you know, you do a lot of this work. You know this, of course. You do a lot of this work on paper. It's a sort of hyper-articulated process. Once the music gets in there, the music is somehow, it's about allowing the unconscious to inhabit the story. And so it's always feeding back on things. I'm like, oh God, now the music's in there. I don't need Robert saying this. I don't need Jed saying this. Take those out. Mm-hmm. You know, suddenly the pacing changes. Everything kind of gets reformatted. But
so a lot of what you're doing is you're paring things down. You're whittling away the story to condense and to make it, I don't know, move faster.
Yes, but it's a multi-layered composition. So the words are very important, and the back and forths are very important, and the music is very important. and they raise their heads in a fugue-like way. Now me, now the it, now that, and so it's extremely musical. Actually.
Yeah, fugue is the right word because it's they're always chasing each other. Yeah.
No, Radiolab is a show about science, but you never really say this is a radio show about science.
And he would rather die than say
I'm assuming that you've thought about this because there are of course the science geeks out there, but there are also a lot of people who just get really intimidated by science if you go deep at all. And so, do you have a philosophy of sort of how you do science on the radio?
Yeah, well, I don't know that this is a show about science or about anything in particular. It's a show that that exists at the point at which a lot of things come together, one of which is science, but also we don't do science in an applied science sort of way. I mean, you hear a lot of stuff on Science Friday, which is great, but it's about, you know, so-and-so made a thing and now they have discovered a thing and they can make something with it. We don't do that kind of stuff. We do the science that leads you to a greater sense of mystery, that bumps you into weird philosophical big ideas that you can just roll around in your head forever. We don't do answers, really. We do questions more than answers. So I think I'll speak for myself. He and I have a slight disagreement about this. I'm very inspired by science. My parents are scientists. I love the rigor of science, but I also hate the rigor of science. So in some sense, I'm in the mystery category. I like sort of the woo-woo stuff, but I also don't trust that in myself. So there's a way in which those two things wrestle, and this show is that wrestling match in some sense. So it isn't science, it's science wrestling with mystery or with the unknown.
Or with just two curious fellows.
You know, yeah.
Who want. So that's the politics of this is very clear to me. When you live in a society where people who have information, and it's complicated information, want to decide things, shall we not dirty the air or dirty the air, or shall we recognize this as the beginning of life or that as the beginning of life? And these are actually turn out to be very important questions. if you don't have the science in you, excuse me, then maybe you just should stay out of the conversation. But no, we don't think that. We think that you just come in to these things and you poke around and you poke the scientists and you ask stupid questions and you argue about what you've just learned. And people on the show tell you that you're wrong and you have to start over. And that what that is that's the theater of learning. And so a lot of journalism begins off stage, and the reporter just goes back and learns everything and gets it right and checks it with the editor and checks it with the source and then presents it to the audience as a finished piece of work, which is the authoritative reporting. We've decided to do unauthoritative reporting.
But
you can hear the authoring going on, you know, and fighting and all this. And that's, I think, how people actually come to knowledge. And so we want to just show you what that's like.
Well, it's interesting to wonder about what your overall purpose of Radiolab is. I mean, is it to entertain, have fun? Is it to educate? I mean, do you want your listeners to come away with greater scientific knowledge than when they started?
I personally don't care about that.
I don't either.
Yeah, I don't.
I think it's more like an expression of a friendship that just happens to have particularly weird quality.
Yeah, that's right.
But you're always dealing with science. I mean, there's always science in your shows.
Well, when we dive into something, like right now we're knee-deep in epigenetics, which is a rat's nest of an explainer, and it's keeping us up at night. But when we're in it, you know, you want to beat the damn thing. You want to make it clear so that I can look to my wife and be like, okay, I'm going to explain to you how DNA gets methylated. And I know the word methylation is a scary word, but stay here. I'm going to explain it to you. I'm going to make this concrete for you. Like, you want that to happen. So in some sense, it's with an eye for those conversations.
Also, there's a sport to it. I mean, he's just come off 50 hours of dealing with that particular question. And he did it. He got it. And it feels to me sometimes when that happens that that's like getting on the top of Mount Everest. That's like looking at, that's what's his name, looking at the other, what's his name, the Sherpa and the white guy. And you just say, look, we're here. We get the view. And that's just fun. Yeah. That's really fun.
But at the end of the day, we're not trying to, there's no sort of hidden agenda to teach or to be the ambassadors of science. That's not where we're coming from.
Well, I was struck by your word methylation, which I don't even know what that means, but anyway. But I'm sure
would you,
you
like
will,
to know what it means, Steve? I can tell you. You know, if you're willing you to let this so interview go for means. 4 hours, I can tell you all about it.
Well, I mean, but it raises an interesting question of when you use science words, and because I mean, one of the things that's striking about Radiolab is, for the most part, you stay away from the big sciencey sounding words. But then, you know, there are some times when obviously you've got to use the words, and then you have to explain them. And do you have a thought out way of dealing with the jargon of science?
Metaphor.
Yeah. We try not to. I mean, sometimes we had a show once, which was a fancy name. It was about randomness, but we chose a very complicated name for it. And that's, I think, the only time we've ever done that.
Because it was just added a certain music to the word. Stochasticity.
Yeah. Stochasticity.
It's
fun to say.
Yeah.
And so at the end, everybody could about for 5 minutes remember what stochasticity.
Well, was. We made it into a kind of almost like a music video theme song.
Yeah.
Stochasticity, You know, like a ripoff of the electric company. Electricity. So you can have fun with it.
But yeah, I think that you try to. I mean, if you really understand what you're talking about, you don't have to use big words. We assume. So it's one of the tests you give yourself. I seem to be strangling here. I don't know why.
What's wrong? What's going on with you?
I don't know. It's like this side of my lung.
I offered you some water. Right? Yeah, just get it out. Just kind of purge.
Okay.
But I mean, you know, I'm in a situation now where we're trying to do a sort of a Rube Goldberg movie of what happens in the brain cell of a rat when the mother licks the rat, is nice to the rat. And it involves 12 different proteins bumping into each other. And you can't really have a good Rube Goldberg experience unless you give those proteins a name. And so you can do the sort of call one George, call one Bob sort of. But then in this case, we're you know, one of them is calling a transcription factor, and one is a growth factor, and one is a and I'm it pains me on a deep level to have to lose the battle of metaphor with these Latinate terms, but sometimes you just have to, you know.
Are you always turning all of this into a story? I mean, I assume there's a narrative arc for every segment that you do. Is that, I mean, are you sort of trying to figure out?
Well, you want to. Sometimes you can't find it, though.
Yeah.
You can get lost looking. And but I think the prize is, this starts me in the dark and gets me to the light somehow. That's the arc somehow.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's a once upon a time sort of story, reading aloud story time kind of feel, and sometimes it's a point counterpoint, you know? I think it works this way. Well, no, on the other hand, it's this way. Well, actually, if you think of it that way, then we should, you know, and then you construct your arc by the ideas getting bounced and rethought. But yeah, it has to feel like a story.
Sometimes it's in a jazzy sort of way. Like jazz is sometimes just about wrestling and listening to yourself wrestle, and sort of it's paying attention to the rhythms of things. And sometimes we do fall into that, like in the case that he's just describing, where you have this cascade of chemistry. It's really the cascade that takes over, and the words just become beats on top of the cascade.
Yeah,
he's created a cascade to do that, and that's really interesting to me, to see how you can actually put your tongue deep into the subject and come out with a story by just adding your sense of taste. It's like it's a value added, and sometimes the magic in jazz case is that he can just find it in the weirdest places, you know. And I don't know how he's going to land the fist. And then you hear the plop. And then I just hug him. Because I don't know what else to do.
Well, it's so interesting to hear how you talk about how music kind of infuses all that you do. Because it almost sounds like you're saying that there's a level where you're playing with ideas, and the ideas, you almost treat them as music in some ways.
Yeah, no, it's what is it? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I think of it this way, you know, he and I were friends before we were collaborators. We would have breakfast a lot at this one particular place, and the conversations we would have were like Radiolab in a way, just an exchange of ideas. He had learned something, I had learned something. He would go off on this crazy, story, and he suddenly would be telling stories of people he'd met or interviewed, and it would be like these thought bubbles would form, I think of this show as an embroidered, musicified version of those breakfasts, in some sense. Mm. So it's like a surrealistic version of the conversations we would actually have. So the music, in some sense, kind of enlivens the conversations and is pulling from the sort of subterranean depths of those conversations. Mm-hmm. But they are conversations.
How did you two meet?
I was in my office at ABC, and NYC needed someone to help them read a promotional material. And so I was told that somebody would come and record my message, which would be written for me. And then I walked down the escalator at ABC News.
I would learn the rule that you never write something for Robert. That's just futile. He will not read it.
Well, so
I walked in. I hand him this bit of inane copy. I support WNYC because it, you know, valued civic com, blah, 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 blah. And he basically tore it up in front of my eyes. I don't know if he really tore it up, but my memory, he tore it up, threw it at me, and then rewrote it into something hilarious involving oil tycoons and alien abduction or something. Right. And I don't know.
Began talking to each other. I was like, who are you? And so, and it turned out that he had done a lot of the things that I had done 25 years earlier. So he'd gone to WBAI, a radio station in New York, so had I. He'd gone to Oberlin College, so had I. He was now at NPR, so had I been. Mm-hmm. And so I just said, well, that's weird. Like, you're hitting the stations of the cross in a different era. So I was just curious, really. And then
we started having breakfast, you know? I mean, we did that for bi-weekly for a year, really.
Were you sort of starting to hatch out the show as you were having these breakfasts?
No, not at all. I mean, Radiolab began, in a roundabout sort of way, I got yanked into this thing called Radiolab right after 9/11 because the schedule was reformatting. And I began to do that. And I would come to him and say, hey, I'm doing this thing. You know, what do you think about this? And then he would give me some advice, or he would say, you should really talk to this person. And we would do that at breakfast.
Right, so I was like mentor guy because I was the older one. And then one day he walks in with something that he had been working on, and I listened to it, and I was stunned, honestly. I was stunned by what I heard. So this is not unusual for me. I've listened and hired people all my life. But this was so much better and so sophisticated work. And, you know, I didn't know that he was really a reporter, or, you know, I knew he was a musician, but he had made made something new in the world. At least that's what it sounded like to me. And I thought, why would I be giving you advice? This is stupid. We should play together. That would be a whole different thing to do. And it was, it was an awkward thing to do because I'm the older one.
I was going to ask about that. I mean, Jed, were you intimidated with the idea of working with Robert? I mean, Robert, you know, kind of a legend in broadcasting circles, certainly in public radio circles.
He had no idea who I was. I was at ABC, I guess.
I actually didn't know who he was at the beginning. I mean, and then I would tell people that, oh, yeah, I'm having breakfast with Robert. Who? With Robert who? Robert Krulwich. Robert Krulwich? The Robert Krulwich? And I learned soon that he was, you know, who he is. But he was intimidating at the beginning because I've since learned the emotional landscape of Krulwich, and I'm now a sort of an expert in it. But at the beginning, you know, Robert believes in something, he's gonna damn well do it, and you have to sort of like a linebacker, like prepared. You have to be a nose tackle when you're working through some of these creative issues. And I just, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing at the beginning, and so I would.
Would you defer to him?
Sure, at the beginning.
I think so. Then,
yeah.
However, the tsunami hit. As he became more able, it was probably Oedipal in some way, but he decided that, you know, he knew what he was doing, and he did. And so then we would have like door slamming.
Yeah, we went through really a period that was really, really hard where we would fight. We would go, I think we'd stop just two ticks shy of actual brawling, physical brawling. But now, you know, to the deferring question, we're now in a place where I kind of need his input on everything, you know. There will be times when I'm working on a piece pretty much from start to finish, but he'll hear it and he'll be like, you know, you're missing this one crucial thing. He'll always have the crucial insight. Mm.
Do you still fight?
Yeah, but we've learned how to control. He can see my fight coming about 13 miles away.
You're like an old married couple. Yeah. You know,
walk over to the other side and sit in a bench and read a newspaper publicly until I'm done. It's sort of ridiculous.
Fight number three coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the same is true for for him. He always kind of knows when.
Yeah, I know.
You know, we know that about each other. So we know we don't fight in that way anymore. Yeah. I mean, we have disagreements all the time, but they're more constructive these days.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that's so striking about Radiolab is the sound of the way you two interact. I mean, the banter, back and forth, very conversational, sounds spontaneous. Mm-hmm. Question is, how spontaneous actually is it? I'm assuming you basically have a script for what you're talking about.
Well, no, we don't really. We have a point. At least in my mind, we had to compete against Ira Glass's This American Life, which was the sort of masterpiece that we were sort of thinking about, and he scripted. So one of the things we thought tactically would be, let's not do that so that we are just in a different place than he is, which doesn't mean that we don't know exactly what we're doing, but we write it down and then we unwrite it down. He'll say, okay, we'll do a couple of passes where I'm sort of looking at notes, and then he'll say, okay, now go get free or whatever. And then we do it again and again. And then you get a highlight reel of casual, a highly cut and edited highlight reel of casual conversation based on pre-scripted conversation. If anyone were to try to put this in a textbook, it would just be, the title of the book would be called "Don't."
it's sort of like improv. It seemed like the craziest thing in the world for me until we talked to improv comics. This is kind of what they do. I mean, they have a blueprint. They've got a roadmap. You kind of know who's who at any given time. You know how fast you got to get from one point to the other. You know generally some things about tone, and then you just kind of like make up stuff, and you start talking, and your brain catches up. And that's kind of what we do. You know, there are places like where it gets super technical that you just can't improvise. You've got to kind of like really sort of write your way through it. But then there are places where we're trying to figure something out, or where we're really reflecting. And we will improvise those for an hour and just take the best 3 minutes, you know?
Because one thing that often happens is one of you is going to be kind of explaining the thing that we're about to hear. You know, it's sort of like one of you knows the story.
The knower and the virgin.
Right. Yeah. Well, and the virgin is the one who's saying, wow, that's amazing.
We try and keep the virgin truly virginal.
Well, that's my question. As I was wondering, I mean, are you just sort of, playing that you're ignorant, or are you really ignorant when you...
It's pretty. About 80-20.
Yeah, 80-20. And the times when we have to pretend to be ignorant, this is going to sound like a rationalization, but really what we're trying to do is reconstruct a point earlier in the process where we actually didn't know. So it's not, you know, having any of us pretend to be something we're not is, I think, off limits. You know, it's like I can say, really? Even though I actually knew in that moment what was about to happen. But five beats ago in the process, as we were thinking about the story, there was a moment where I said, really?
Yeah.
And so you're just kind of getting back to that previous version of yourself, you know?
So it's sort of pretend, but it's but it's basically real.
Because there's such, I mean, I've thought about this a lot. I mean, there's sort of this line between, I guess, what you would call the authentic conversation, and then there's the performance side of it. Yeah. And, I mean, you're really saying you need both.
Because this is obviously... It's a very manufactured conversation, because there's all of this acts of manufacture that you can hear. People are suddenly there and suddenly gone. Mm-hmm. And so it is with respect to the audience, actually, that we say, all right, this is a new form. Now, there are a lot of people who have great difficulty with this, either because of the level of production, because of the apparent messy and distractedness of it, and they don't like it. But that's... understandable, because it is a new form, and Jad is inventing it as we go, and I'm just like trying to keep up with it. Or actually, it's actually fun for me. I'm not trying to. I enjoy it very much. But it is new, and everyone has to get used to it. And then as soon as we get used to it, we change it again.
Yeah,
because in that sense, it is again like jazz. It has to be. It has to be fresh.
I want to come back to what you said earlier, that when you started this, you didn't want to just repeat what Ira Glass had done. And he has been very admiring about what you do. I mean, he's described Radiolab as inventing a new kind of aesthetic. You've already said that his show is more scripted than yours. What else did you do to not just sound like you're doing This American Life?
Yeah, I mean, I went through a long period of sounding like Ira at the very beginning. I mean, you know, no one, I think, talks about the mechanics of storytelling better than he does. I continually go back to some of the things he's written and said, and so I feel like actually half the time we're pretending that we're not stealing from him, is what I think. I think we're actually ripping him off quite frequently, but just cloaking it in a completely new style.
Is it partly, I mean, one of the big things is, I mean,
he's a very close friend of mine, and I really like him a lot. But I cannot do what he does because I don't want to in some part of me. I mean, he's rejected everything I've handed in and so forth, because it just doesn't fit. But that's not true. But he's rejected a lot of things. But I think we're us and he's him, and I don't have to worry about that too much. He knows so precisely what he's doing, and we so don't. And there's a poetry in not knowing, just as there is in the knowing. He'll come to our shows and he'll like be sitting there in the seat. The other day we went to one that was actually a dance company that he loves, and he's sitting there in the chair reorganizing the show. He keeps turning to this. Actually, they're overplaying that one quarter. They should put the thing in the front and the back. I was like, come on, can't you just put your editing brain down? He just can't. Whereas I just go and just watch what happens. Like, that was good. I feel like stupid next to him in a way, but I also, there's something nice about not knowing everything.
Maybe the big way that you've done something very different from what he does, the fact that there are two of you. I mean, that entirely changes the dynamic of how you present a radio show.
I'm not trading Jed in for anything.
Well, also there's an idea. The idea that the fact that there are two of us isn't just theatrical. I mean, it's like the what we always, you know, how when earlier I said that we don't really ever get to answers, because often what'll end up happening is that we'll get to this, I'm going to use a dumb word, plurality, and there are two things which are interesting to us at the same time, and they seem to be opposing, and one of us will sort of, I think this happens organically, he'll fall on one side and I'll fall on the other, and for me one of the greatest joys of this is bumping into those moments where you really do feel like you're trying to grapple with two things which are mutually exclusive, and yet they're in your head at the same time, and you're just going to hold them both, and you're not going to let one win. I think that's kind of the funnest part of what we're doing, and that's why it's really kind of a blessing to have this guy across the table, because we can play that kind of weird balance for each other that makes the world more interesting, more complicated.
Now, I also have to ask you about this kind of strange studio setup that you have here, and we should say that I'm actually sitting in the Radiolab studio looking at both of you through a piece of glass, and that's the way you do the show, right? I mean, you're sitting in opposite studios but looking at each other through glass. So why?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
I don't really
know. It's
a
very easy answer to that.
Some kind of engineer. I used to work with Ted Koppel at ABC. He had the same thing. You would come and he'd be in a studio and he'd be talking to a camera. And you'd be there with him. And you'd have your camera. And then you'd be on your screen. He'd be on your screen. And you couldn't like turn to the left and say, you know I don't mean that, Ted. Because he would only talk to America or something. I don't know. I don't know why we have
that. It's completely different. It's completely different in this case because we edit things so damn much, we have to decouple the voices. And so the glass sort of keeps each of us acoustically separated. Ah. So that when we edit things, you know, I mean, here's the thing, and you're experiencing this now. We're constantly talking over each other. You know, we're talking at the same time. And in the edit, what I'll do is I'll just pull our voices just slightly apart so that you can hear what we're saying. If you didn't do that, it'd be a total mess. We'd just be talking over each other constantly. Yeah.
So, and then is it sometimes where you'll leave one of your tracks and the other one will recut another track and then you'll, you know,
yeah, everything's fair game. You know, I mean, it just has to feel like you said that sort of that tension between authenticity and showmanship. I mean, there's showmanship for sure. This is a complete farce what we're doing, but as long as it's authentically from something we've said or something we would say. It's an authentic farce.
It also sounds like it would take forever to put together one of your pieces. I mean, given all of this post-production.
It doesn't take forever. It takes 6 weeks.
It takes a crazily long amount of time.
6 weeks to do what?
To do one hour.
1 hour.
Yeah. And, you know, how we do it now is we have, at any given time, you know, we have a list of six that are stretch off into the future, and we've got three that are on our plate, more or less, two that are sort of percolating, and one that's sort of front burner, and that takes 6 weeks, start to finish.
There have been occasions where, you know, we've somehow hopped to it, and things have rushed through like a happy wind, And there have been other occasions where it's taken 2 years. Mm-hmm. So that's a median number you're getting there.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. And when we first realized the pace at which we were working, I couldn't think of like what it would be, what you would do with it.
Like, it's not crazy anymore.
I know,
it's
now
like,
it is.
And there are a lot of places. I feel like we were sort of we're an HBO-ish way of making stuff, you know?
But I never heard of that then. Like, you know, you make 11 things a year. Who do you sell that to? Who wants 11? It's not even a baker's dozen.
That's why public radio invented the special hour.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah.
I want to play another clip from a different Radiolab show. This is about the toy, the Furby toy. And you are talking with an MIT scientist named Freedom Baird. And let's listen.
Can you describe a Furby for those of us who...
Sure. It's about 5 inches tall, and the Furby is pretty much all head. It's just a big, round, fluffy head with two little feet sticking out the front. It has big eyes.
Apparently, it makes noises.
Yep. If you tickle its tummy, it will coo. It would say, kiss me, and it would want you to just keep playing with it. So, you know, I spent about 10 weeks using the Furby. I would carry it around in my bag.
And one day she's hanging out with her Furby, and she notices something
very eerie. What I discovered is if you hold it upside down, it will say,
me scared.
Me scared. Uh-oh. Me scared. And me, as the, you know, the sort of owner slash user of this Furby, would get really uncomfortable with that and then turn it back up, upright.
Because once you have it upright, it's fine. It goes right back.
And then it's fine. So it's got some sensor in it that knows, you know, what direction it's facing.
Basically. Or maybe it's just scared.
Sorry.
Anyway, she thought, well, wait a second now. This could be sort of a new way that you could use to draw the line between what's human
and what's machine.
Yeah.
Kind of, it's this kind of emotional Turing test.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Can I hear you?
Hey, if we actually wanted to do this test, could you help? How would we do it exactly?
How are you guys doing?
We're good.
Yeah?
You would need a group of kids.
Can you guys tell me your name?
I'm Olivia.
Louisa.
Turin.
Darl.
Lila.
And I'm Sadie.
All right.
I'm thinking 6, 7, and 8-year-olds.
And how old are you guys?
7.
The age of reason, you know?
8.
Then says Freedom, we're going to need 3 things.
A Furby.
Of course.
Barbie.
A Barbie doll. And...
Gerby. That's a gerbil.
A real gerbil?
Yeah.
And we did find one, except it turned out to be a hamster.
Sorry, you're a hamster, but we're going to call you Gerby.
So you've got Barbie, Furby, Gerby.
Barbie, okay. Furby, and Gerby.
Okay. Right.
So wait just a second. What question are we asking in this test?
The question was, how long can you keep it upside down before you yourself feel uncomfortable?
Okay, another great piece of tape. I mean, you're doing so much there. You're layering voices, layering sounds. How did you put that together?
I think we read about the experiment in a book by an MIT professor, which led us to...
And Freedom was Freedom. I think, one of her students.
Was
I think
her students, that, yeah. Who was actually an Oberlin person also, interestingly. So then we just asked her to describe the experiment, and Jad was taking furious notes and basically then executed it.
I think she, if I remember correctly, she hadn't actually done it. She said, this would be interesting. And then she hadn't actually gone through with it. And we thought, whoa, well, we have to do it. Because there seemed to be a real interesting question. You know, I mean, you hold a Barbie doll upside down. That doesn't seem, I mean, you can, I think any kid of any age can just hold it upside down forever. A gerbil, that's going to be really uncomfortable. But a Furby, uncomfortable
question.
Or not would it be for a kid to hold that upside down? So that was the real question. How much time could they do it in relation to Barbie or the Gerby? And so it was driven by a real curiosity. We didn't know. And so we had the interview with Freedom. We had a bunch of kids who we'd brought in over the course of a week. And we thought, they're telling the same story, one in a kind of past tense and one in a present tense. So let's just see if we can sort of weave them.
And that's the thing that's unusual about what you do. I mean, the normal way a radio producer would do that is, you know, they'd interview the scientist first, then you leave the scientist, and then you go and you visit the kids, and then, but you're kind of mixing it all together.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, if you watch film, I mean, there's a word for this. I forget what they call it, where it's so commonplace in film and TV that you don't even notice it, where one scene bleeds into the other, you know, where you tail end of one scene, you're suddenly hearing audio from the succeeding scene, and then you cut to that scene, and it's just so commonplace. And so there's some way in which I feel like the techniques of film are guiding our choices here.
Yeah, you know? Which literally means when, you know, I'm reading this book by Sherry Turkle, and I see this thing about Furby, I then show it to Jad, and then what happens is I think we both see a movie. That's, you know, and so we thought, well, let's make that movie, except in sound. Mm-hmm. And so that's all that happens. It's like, so what, with the thing you alluded to before, where there's a shrimp that sees more colors than others, that came out of a movie that just came up in the middle of a conversation where we were just playing around with who sees more colors in the rainbow. And we didn't read that anywhere. He just then answered our question that there are differences in rainbow seeing and that there's a calibration and they have characters, including, of all things, a little shrimp that sees more colors in the rainbow than anyone else on Earth. That just felt instantly like a movie to me, mm-hmm. and to Jad too.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the question, you know, well, we're working in this medium that has no pictures in it. What do you do? And it's those are the questions which just, in terms of craft, are always, that's why I get up in the morning. It's not stuff you discuss on the air, you know, but it's the thing that kind of like, what can we do to make you see a rainbow the way a shrimp sees a rainbow on the radio? It's just, it's a ridiculous question.
And then that leads him to a church in Harlem where 100 and some odd people volunteer to come and sing. And, you know, we have diction issues about whether you can say mantis shrimp. Can you get the P? and he's sitting there in a church with all these singers and then having them essentially sing lines of dialogue that we have already spoken. Mm-hmm. That's just fun.
Yeah. There's no other reason to do it except because it's fun.
Now, another thing you do when you talk to these scientists, somehow you get them to talk like real people. Do you have tricks to that? I mean, so they don't sort of lapse into
Crowich is kind of the master at that. I used to do a lot of interviews where you kind of, I would slip into the false mission of trying to get them to like me. And oh, yes, I understand what you're saying. Oh, okay, mm-hmm. And I'm nodding a lot. Robert takes a very different approach, which is he kind of... it's not so much that. I mean, every so often that happens, but very rarely. It's more just, you're just kind of a clown isn't the right word, because that means that you're just kind of
no, I'm actually
free-flowing.
I'm consciously setting an emotional parameter. So I laugh and cough and do unbroadcasty things.
You interrupt a lot.
Interrupt myself. I interrupt him, interrupt myself. I act like no one's looking. But of course, the equipment and everything that's going on suggests quite otherwise. But it creates a dissonance in the person. They don't know what's going on.
Suddenly they're like, wait.
It's like you've gone to a dinner party and everyone shows up in pajamas. Like, what are you supposed to do?
It's exactly that way, actually.
So you're throwing them off their game to get them on their true game.
Yes.
You know, because everybody's so, if they're not media trained, they have some idea of what they should sound like. And you're always trying to sort of drag them away from that.
Yeah, and I've covered economics where businessmen talk, and I've covered diplomacy and war and generals in particular, and they have to be very, very careful because they're managing a life or death situation, and those are very orchestrated, and so are any entertainment. Like if you want to interview a celebrity, the celebrity has fixers and attached notary and has made deals and will include this and not include that. So it's actually, this is easy compared to that. This is, I learned it really in the more difficult terrains where everything is orchestrated. So you have to come into the orchestra with your bow and bring some chaotic device to wreck up the concert.
There's also there's just the simple questions you ask. I mean, you can ask, you can engage the science and you can treat what they're doing as information, mm-hmm. or you can ask them the basic question, which I think everybody asks, you know, how did you get into this? Mm-hmm. They say, well, you know, I was in grad school. Like, no, forget that. How did you get into this? And if you connect to that, whatever it was, the catalytic spark, that sometimes creates a different conversation.
Actually, it's very hard for someone to resist someone really paying attention.
Yeah, that's right.
And really, what we really do at the end is we really want to figure something out. And something that it's beyond the fact that they're mostly teachers or investigators, it's that they're humans, they're animals, and they hear someone sniffing for the very thing that they've been sniffing at, and they want to help you. That's really what happens. But you have to make that happen. And partly that's just revealing your own really rich, unabashed curiosity, even at the cost of your dignity.
That's the truth, though. Yeah.
I want to come back to the Furby piece for a moment because you have a beautiful ending to that piece. So there's this whole question of, you know, this toy that talks, and is it alive? Is it not alive? How do people perceive this? And you sort of think, okay, it's still a toy, but then you tell the story about how this MIT scientist gave a Furby to her grandmother who has Alzheimer's, and she loved the Furby, and the Furby was more than just a toy to her. And it took that piece to a whole different level at that point.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Furby piece. I really like that piece. Because, sitting with those kids and hearing them really struggle with, was the Furby scared? Like, you felt scared as a kid. Do you think the Furby felt like that when you're holding it upside down? And they would say, yes, no.
No.
Well, maybe. Yeah, nah, I don't know. Well, sort of. You know, and just hearing those ways in which they're investing this thing with a little bit of life, and yet they know it's a toy. And Freedom is doing the same thing at the end there. She's holding both of those ideas at once, and I don't know, that's something, there's something.
No, because it's a description of a kind of dementia, really, where you're an adult, you've lived a life, and now just the animal comfort of laughter and something soft, something that won't leave, becomes important to you. And there's something terribly tragic, but also
I know, it is tragic. Yeah, beautiful. I think it's quite.
And it's almost as if you've sort of been dealing with this very heady sort of intellectual idea of, you know, what's the difference between life and non-life? And then you have this real-world example of this woman who apparently is profoundly moved by playing with this toy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the wonderfulness of this, which is that categories and expectations are always shattered by experience. And part of the fun of investigating anything is the surprise. And so the surprise can be very many levels. You can be surprised that you understand something, then you can be surprised where it leads you, and then you can be very surprised where it led someone else, you know, to someplace different than you. And all those are just different ways of seeing. And
the
niceness of this is that we can see them in every way we can. Yeah.
Have you ever seen Hellboy 2?
I saw Hellboy 1. I can't remember if I saw it.
There's no reason you should have seen that movie. It's not a great movie. But there is this particular creature. They call him an ectoplasm or something, but he was smoke. He was made of smoke. And he needed to have a suit in the shape of a body, and he would inhabit that suit, and that would be how he could move through the world. And I think sometimes I think of the ideas we work with sometimes as smoke. They need bodies. They need to inhabit some form, or else they're not real. They can't actually work. And so for me,
wow, I've never heard this one.
I don't know. It's a straight. Just came to mind.
I know Rembrandt often spoke of Hellboy too.
But somehow, were it not for that story from Freedom about her grandma, these ideas would remain vaporous in some way. They need to inhabit people just getting their coat on and walking out the door. Otherwise, they don't exist for me. You know.
One final question. Do either of you have a dream Radiolab story? Maybe something that's hard to do, but sort of the thing that you really want to do.
I had one called Ants.
You have realized that dream.
For years, I was waiting to do a story called How Ants Had Taken Over the Earth Invisibly.
When he says years, he's not exaggerating.
And I had to, yes, I've realized my dream. A few months ago, it actually aired after many years. So, I am now between dreams, you might say.
If I have a dream, it's funny. I mean, it's a hard question to answer because if we get an idea, then we do it. You know, I mean, that's one of the gifts of this thing is that we can follow our own curiosities. But the thing that I do think about quite often is I'm Lebanese. You know, we moved over here, I guess, just as I was born. And I've been back a bunch of times, and I've done some reporting from there. I think a lot about spending a lot of time there and doing some reporting from there and finding the Radiolab stories we can tell from there, be they sort of in about the environmental situation there, which is catastrophic, or about the sectarian relationships. I don't know what it would be, but it's just a personal curiosity I've always had. And I dream about somehow dragging the show there at some point.
I accidentally had an almost Lebanese experience a few months ago. I flew to Tel Aviv after having given a commencement speech in Maine. So it was Maine, Philadelphia, JFK, Istanbul, Tel Aviv. So I was tired. And I got into a train to go to Haifa, where I was supposed to go next, which is at the Technion institution in Haifa. And I fell asleep, and I slept through the Haifa stop. I slept through the next stop, the next stop, the next stop, and the next stop. And when Israel is a tiny little country, and when I woke up, there was no more Mediterranean. I was looking out the window at the Mediterranean, and the Mediterranean. And I open up, and now there's barbed wire, which, of course, means that's Lebanon. I got out of there. Where am I? So you're now next to Lebanon. I said, oh. I said, now how will I? So I get out of the train, and there's all these guys lounging around, all soldiers of some kind. And I said, look, I need to figure out a way to get back to Haifa. Does anybody like it? So I said, well, my brother's coming up with laundry, so maybe he'll drive you at least to Netanya, which is a town. I said, okay. So I'm waiting. And then he looks at me, just looks at me and says, wait a second. Are you from Radiolab?
Get out.
And all these, get out. All these parachute people that, whoa, you Jed or Robert? I said, I'm Robert. I said, oh, my God. I said, you just knew that from The Voice. They say, yeah, because it's now, because of Steve Jobs, we're now in Beirut and in Haifa and in these places, because we can be. And so you never know. He could go and buy Chiclets in Beirut and go, who are you, Krolwich or the other
That's
one?
Funny. Yeah. I'll meet you across the barbed wire sometime.
So the lesson is Radiolab is taking over the world.
or running into its barbed wire.
A small sliver of border between two warring countries.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is really fun.
Oh, yeah. This is great. Thanks. It's terrific.